Okay. Well, today we're going to tie up a few loose ends, and we're going to talk a little bit about some future trends and some things that are happening. There's lots going on because of the transition and the environment and the pandemic. So today we're going to clean up some loose ends from the last couple of PLCs that had to do with training during COVID. And then we're going to talk a little bit about environmental justice today and some, I call them green shoots, that from our perspective seem to be sprouting in this world of environmental workforce development. We always start out with news from Washington. So Heather, could you give us a rundown of what's happening?
All right. Well, good afternoon or good morning, everybody. We appreciate you guys joining us on today's phone call. You know, we're still kind of in the midst of that long wait period, so there's no news from HQ. But as always, we do want to share and remind with you all the news about the National Brownfields Conference. That's always something that we've been reminding you all about every time we meet here for the PLC call. So I'm going to remind you all about that as well. So if you don't have it marked on your calendars yet, the National Brownfields Conference is September 27th through the 30th in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And if you'd like to learn more information about that, please visit brownfields2021.org. Again, that's brownfields2021.org, and that'll tell you some great information on that one. And the exciting thing, too, is they actually reopened the call for ideas. So if you had wanted to submit an idea to participate in the National Brownfields Conference, but you didn't get to it the first time around, they reopened up their call for ideas, and that is actually open until March 8th. So again, if you want to learn more about that, go to that brownfields2021.org. And just to let you know, HMTRI, we did submit two different call for ideas during the first go around. And so we are kind of excited to hear to see if you know, we'll be called to participate during the National Brownfield Conference. We are also planning on having a booth during the National Brownfield Conference, but more specifically, it is an EWGDT booth. So it's an area for think of it as all of you all to have a space to showcase your programs in a national forum. So it's kind of similar to what we did in LA a couple years ago at the 2019 National Brownfields Conference. So we wanted to do that again here at this one. So it'll be that EWGJT booth, an opportunity for you guys to be able to showcase your programs and really highlight them out there. So we'll talk about this more as it gets a little bit closer and as things get finalized, but just know that we are planning on having a booth space available during that time. And, you know, we are also still looking at the possibility of having that affiliate event the day before the National Brownfields Conference. And again, this is very reminiscent of what we did during the 2019 National Brownfields Conference, for those of you who were able to join us at that one as well. But that's where we, you know, have a moment to really focus in on everything EWGDT right before the National Brownfields Conference and hopefully meet that, you know, have that conversation and really explore some of those topics that are near and dear to all of our hearts, you know, as we go. So we'll keep you guys in the loop as things go and continue to develop, but we just wanted to keep you in the loop on what we were thinking and planning and hoping to do as those dates continue to grow closer and closer and as we are excited and looking forward to that. So again, brownfields2021.org for more information on the National Brownfields Conference, and keep that in mind. Now, some information on the HMTRI side of the house we wanted to let you guys know. We are looking at having a special mid-year webinar to replace one of the PLC dates that is up and coming. So that will be March 10th. So on March 10th, instead of your regularly occurring PLC phone call, we're actually going to be holding a Zoom webinar. And it'll be during the same time frame that the PLC call takes place. But instead, we'll have you all jump onto a Zoom link, and we're going to be having a really great time talking about lessons learned, so in-person training during the COVID-19 pandemic. And we have some folks that are willing to jump on and join us and really share some of their insights and best practices and, well, maybe not best practices, but some of their high successes that they've had during this past year. So we've reached out. We've got Elizabeth Cornell from Limitless Vistas, Ken Alexander from Recycle Force, and Renee Dooley from St. Louis Community College. And they will be coming together to explore lessons learned during the global pandemic. We'll be highlighting successes and challenges associated with protecting instructors and students when delivering in-person training. So keep an eye out. Registration link will be going out here shortly. And we look forward to having you guys join us in this special mid-year webinar. Another event that's coming up soon that we wanted to keep on your guys' radar is our all-grantee meeting. For those of you who may not have joined us before, this is a great opportunity to get together and really explore those topics that are relevant to those in the Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training Program. So typically, it's usually held at a different time of year and it's held in person, but you know, we are all in this newly adapting pandemic world that we are currently in. So we are going virtual, and we are going virtual in May. So we are looking at May 4th through the 6th, going virtual through Zoom, and being held from 12 to 3 p.m. Eastern. So May 4th through 6th, 12 to 3 p.m. Eastern, mark that on your calendar. We're looking forward to having a fantastic virtual all-grantee meeting, getting everybody together once again to explore these topics that are close to us and really get in and discuss those environmental workforce development and job training programs. So just a couple of things that are coming in on the books we wanted to share with you guys, and we look forward to continuing some of these discussions. So Mike, I'm going to toss it back over your way, but thank you for taking a moment and letting me share some of these news and exciting things that are up and coming.
Well, one thing about the pandemic is that it's going to give us an opportunity to have two all-grantee meetings because we need to go virtual in May. We'll do what we did last year and get together and have breakout rooms and discussions and videos and tours of our grantees, but we won't be together. What we're hoping, though, is by the time September 27th comes around in Brownfields, we'll be able to have a pre-conference face-to-face meeting where we can get together. And of course, everybody has expressed the value of in-person networking and discussion. So we're hoping that that will continue September 27th, depending on how things go this summer. We're all in the same boat. We're not sure how this will turn out, but as a plan B, we certainly will have this face-to-face in May. I also, on that same subject of what's happening at EPA, there's nominations, and all of this is going to be in the notes that will go out on Friday, but there are nominations for the NEJAC committee advisory board. That's the National Environmental Justice Advisory Committee, which we'll be talking about today a little later. The NEJAC is been around almost since the beginning of the program, and it's an advisory capacity to EPA. They have nominations that will be closing March 24th. So some of the grantees, some of you may be interested in nominating someone to sit on that committee and provide the EPA with your perspective in job training in underserved communities. Again, we'll put the details, what you need to do that, get involved in that. When we talk about what's happening to our grantees and some of the events that are happening, I'd like to spend a little bit of time. What's happening in Washington, because there's lots of things going on. There's some reorganizations and people moving up. For example, in EPA, the new head of EPA is going to be Michael Regan, who is from North Carolina, where I'm at. He helped establish the Environmental Justice Program in North Carolina. We're looking forward, for a lot of reasons, for Michael's guidance and leadership in EPA. We also want to acknowledge Sharon Beard, who all of you know, both alumni and people who have been around for a while. She has been at every one of our all-grantee meetings, the virtual meeting. Sharon is just tremendous. She's with NIHS, and she'll be heading up the Worker Education and Training Program, our sister program in NIHS. and has expressed her interest in continuing to work with us. So we're really excited about Sharon. Now, Sharon replaced Chip Hughes, and many of you know Chip from being to one of our all-grantee meetings. Chip was the former director of the Worker Education and Training Program, but he's moved on to OSHA. And Chip has essentially retired from NIHS, but has been selected as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Pandemic and Emergency Response. Chip has been a big supporter of the program and a great guy. He was the leader in the whole 9/11 issue when the Trade Centers collapsed. He fought for making sure there was worker protection and the people that were going in were protected. He's been instrumental in all of the developments in worker training program in NIHS. And while we're happy to see Sharon move into his spot. Sad to see him go, but he will be a tremendous resource for all of you in OSHA, which is so integrated to our program. So we'll keep that in mind. While we're talking about NIHS and Chip and Sharon, I just wanted to do a shout out to Montgomery Prophet, if he's on the line. Congratulations. They featured you as the work you're doing in worker training program. Montgomery has been a tremendous and remains a tremendous asset to our program. He's also participated in most of our all grantee meetings, been instrumental in, as many of you remember, the tryout programs that they've developed, but has done a tremendous job both in the NIHS worker training program and also in the Environmental Workforce Development Job Training Program. Of course, these are kind of sister programs. Theirs is more focused on health and safety. Ours is more focused on environmental remediation, but it's been a tremendous contribution. The last person I want to recognize while we're talking about people moving up and new people is a woman you may never have heard of, is Shalanda Baker. And Shalanda, and this is what I want to talk about next, she was nominated or chosen by President Biden to be the Deputy Director for Energy Justice. And I don't know how many of you have heard about energy justice. I've been talking about environmental justice a lot. Environmental justice is why we exist, of course. It's the reason and justification for training underserved people, unemployed, underserved in communities that have been neglected, and giving them an opportunity to train and develop certifications in environmental remediation and including some health and safety that goes right along with it. Well, this is an interesting, and I termed it as green shoots that are going on, and I'm going to talk about them in a minute. But Shalanda has been in the area of energy justice for a while. She has been doing this as a law professor at Northeastern University. She's got a Fulbright. She's worked in energy justice for a long time. She's actually come out with a book on revolutionary power, they call it, and the energy justice program. And I want to spend a little time talking about energy justice, but also environmental justice. And I want to just enlighten or bring to all of our attention that EJ, environmental justice, social justice, and now energy justice are flowing through the entire government. And we talk about it, and we've talked about it in one of the Connect issues. But this is a program that really started as nothing new. It started in 1987, actually, not far from where I live. This was in Warren County, North Carolina, where they were trying to locate a tremendously hazardous waste site. And the people in Warren County, of course, this was a underserved community, much like many of our brownfields communities or even Superfunds. And the United Church of Christ got involved, and they protested and demonstrated, and brought attention to the whole idea of where are we locating our transfer stations, where are we locating our landfills, where are all the Superfunds. And later on, of course, Mr. Bullard, Dr. Bullard, who worked with us quite a while ago, overlaid and wrote several books on when you overlay morbidity on top of where the underserved populations are, they overlay directly. And the attention started to mount. And interestingly enough, about 1992, now that's back in 87, we go to 92, and between that time, the movement started to progress, and George Bush actually set up a working group, and it was to look at environmental justice and some of the things that Bullard was talking about and some of the things, the complaints that some of the underserved communities were expressing, and it started to percolate at that time. But things really didn't start in federal government till 94. Now, again, this was during President Clinton's term in office. He wrote the first executive order, which still is the guidepost for EJ. It was an executive order 12898, and that was signed, actually, and the reason I'm talking about justice today, it was 27 years ago, February 10th. So this day, 27 years ago, was the beginning of environmental justice, which continues on today and justifies the reason and what we're doing with our program. That, over the years, has flourished and had waned, depending on the administration that was involved, been supported by both Republicans and Democrats, and it's also been not so supported by Republicans and Democrats. So it depends on the administration that's in there and what the public sentiment it is. It appears as if during this administration, it is a focal point. And we talked about the January 20th, some of the first executive orders that President Biden signed had to do, as we said, I believe in the last PLC, it's an executive order that has to do with climate change. But if you read that executive order carefully, the first half has to do with climate change. The second half has to do with jobs, job training, job development, brownfields. And this is very important to us. And it's and I'm going to talk about this in a second. That appears to be very important in terms of what appears to be priorities of this administration. What's interesting, and I'm bringing up Shalanda's appointment, which is energy justice. The same thing is popping up. And if you read about energy justice, of what's happening in Department of Energy, it's almost parallel to what started to happen in EPA, in environmental justice. Some of the wording is very similar. Some of the, as you read the what they're doing, it's somewhat similar. And why am I bringing this up? And it's really background information we're talking about today. I want to just let all of you know to keep your eyes open, be aware. Many of our grantees are doing energy and environmental justice to some extent. We've got some outstanding grantees who certainly are doing environmental justice, remediation of hazardous waste sites, brownfields work, but many of them also involved, we've got grantees like ECA, has a tremendous night center involved in energy. We've got many others who are involved in energy. And what I would just like to do is suggest these programs are existing across different agencies. And these are just EPA and DOE in terms of energy justice, environmental justice. We're not sure what might be coming along in some of the other departments. So as an EPA grantee, and many of our grantees start out in EPA, start building their job training programs, and they find that they expand, and they find that many of the capabilities and the overflow from our program may flow into NIHS is in Janet's program down in Santa Fe. They're doing quite a bit in, with other programs that are very synergistic to ours. And it makes both programs better because the arts program up in Arts Shanks and Eric's program up in San Francisco, where they're training in our program, but we're also able to leverage our $200,000 programs into multi-million dollar programs by working together and using some synergism in these programs. So I just wanted to spend a little bit of time today talking about EJ, and I don't want our grantees to lose sight of who we are, and I do keep reminding that because really it's when you think about EPA and some of the most critical administrations that said, what are you doing training? Why are you training? That belongs in Department of Labor. That is not an EPA program. There are many justifications for having an EPA. One is the very technical nature, where if it was in a Department of Labor program, it might be swamped. It's very specialized, and it's a very small program that that addresses a specific niche. But more important than that, it's an environmental justice program, and that would not exist anywhere else. And it also is part of EPA's goal of promoting environmental justice. So again, when you start thinking about your program plans, for those of you who are on the call and you're anticipating perhaps you don't have a grant now, and you're anticipating writing a grant for the next RFA that will be coming out later in the year, you may want to keep this in mind that we're not a Department of Labor program. We're an EPA program, and we're an environmental justice program. So enough said with that. Are there any questions on that? I just wanted to give you all that background that you may not be aware of, and just keep that in the back of your mind. It does have implications in terms of designing your program and what we're going to talk about next, which is recapping the COVID, what's happening in training and COVID, and how we address our training strategies. Anyone had any questions about EJ, Environmental Justice and EPA, or Energy, or some of the other programs? Okay, let's talk a little bit about COVID. And now the last two PLCs we've talked about COVID, and of course that's the elephant in the room right now. HMTRI did two scans, one on March 16th, and then one at the end of the year, December 28th. And if you look at the progression of what happened over the last year, and we've all been through the ringer on this one, a year ago, January 31st, there were about 200 worldwide deaths. It was hardly, as you remember, not real significant. They didn't think it was going to be too big a deal. But by May, there were 100,000 deaths from January to May, 100,000 deaths. It started to get real serious about April, March-April timeframe. By December, when we did our second scan, we did our first scan March 16th to see what grantees were doing, how are they responding, everything was shutting down. By December 31st, there were 20 million worldwide deaths, and in the U.S. there are 346,000 deaths just in the U.S. By the last week or so, we're up to 500,000 deaths. So the interesting thing is when we did this March scan, we pretty much all panicked and program shut down, public health. We didn't know how long this was going to be. In our scans, basically, we're saying we had three problems. We had three issues with our grantees. We had the new grantees who were probably in the best shape because they were just in the planning stages. And I know many of you are new grantees. They were anticipating or planning a cohort. We had some that had been a little further along. They were actually in the recruiting process. The grantees that had the roughest time were in the middle of a cohort, halfway through. And then there were some that had just finished a cohort and they were placing their graduates. One thing about environmental workforce grantees is, and this is by design, they are all different. They are probably the most diverse type of grantees you would see on a topic area. They range from tribal, rural, small communities to urban populated centers. They're working with organizations that have their own rules, with counties in counties that have their own public health concerns, in geographies that have their own issues regarding the COVID. And so we wanted to try to get a feel back in March what was happening. And of course, going back to some of the PLCs that we, during that time, most of the feedback was that we have to shut down. Our facilities are closed. There were some that were able to stay open. Recycle Forest, it was deemed an essential industry because of their work. They continued to be able to work, and they were able to keep going. Most programs just shut down. Most of them expressed concern, what's going to happen if this thing continues? When is this going to end? And back then, we were thinking, oh, this might end in April or maybe in the summer. At that point, we thought, even at that point, we will just delay it for a while. Some talk started with distance learning. And of course, this gets back to the point of what I was talking about, EJ. Because we're an EJ program, almost by definition, many of our applicants don't have computers. They're not computer literate. They may have a cell phone. They may not have a cell phone service. They may or may not have internet service. So by the nature of our, which is different than many NIHS programs where they're dealing with trainers who are very savvy to distance learning. They've got the computers, they've got the programs. Our participants have not necessarily any of these. Some do, but few. So out of 40 or so programs, we may have half a dozen who have participants that were ongoing that were doing some sort of distance learning or were able to do computers. So this is a tremendous shock to the system. And of course, the issues at that time were just maintaining contact with their students. If they had a class that they had recruited, just keeping them interested, keeping somehow engaged in what to tell them, not knowing when the end of this pandemic was going to be. They also had a lot of former graduates that were laid off, and they were coming back looking for either retraining or jobs. So it was an issue. Now, that feedback in March, there seemed to be still somewhat of a demand for people with certifications because of the pandemic. And in fact, some grantees expressed the point of view that we have people who are trained, the ones that have HAZWOPR certificates. They know how to don and doff suits to protect themselves. They've got the health and safety training. They've got the remediation training. They're actually in demand. Whether in some cases they were cleaning buses, city buses, they were going to work as essential workers in remediation and in the biohazard area, essentially. So in that case, in March, most of them were rescheduling these cohorts. And they were those who had teams, the management, of course, were able to communicate internally. When they shut down their offices, they were able to, that's when the Zoom started coming in, the team meetings, the internal communications. Many of our grantees had been doing some distance training. People like Uberell or Oregon Tradeswomen, they amongst themselves, they had training. At that point, as this thing went on, some of the grantees decided, well, this may be the time we may want to start switching to computers. And the issues we talked about at that time were, if you're going to go to distance learning and you go to computers, which is fine. For the last half a dozen years, we've had various programs who provided everyone with tablets and as reference materials and communications, they were using tablets. Florida did it. I think Santa Fe may have been doing it, but different organizations found it was cost effective to give everyone tablets at that time. So there were some grantees who were able to teach some of these courses online or partially online or do what we call a hybrid. So when fast forward, we find that our grantees were learning to live with COVID. When we did the scan in December, though, we found that it's still everyone needs to do in person. There are very few who are attempting to do online courses. It's very difficult. The feedback we were getting is our curriculum's not set up for online. Our participants don't have internet, or the people we're dealing with don't have internet. They don't have the training. They're not used to. Again, they might be ex-offenders. They might be people who haven't been in a school for 20, 30 years. So they're just not in the position of this. So the overall response is we're trying, but we need and we are going back to in-person training. And this is one of the reasons we decided to do a webinar in next month and beginning of March on in-person training. And what we want to do is focus on and we don't know what the best practices are yet, but what are some of the strategies that the grantees are using to go in person? And as we come out of this epidemic, as vaccines start to kick in, and as organizations start opening up, what are the strategies? And in the last PLCs, we talked about that a little bit. Most of the strategies involve limiting class size, spreading out their facilities, finding new facilities where they could spread out. And, of course, those grantees who have large sites like Cypress Mandela or Recycle Force or perhaps Santa Fe where they do a lot of outdoor training, they can spread out, they can distance people. They're more than 6 feet apart. They've got plenty of room. It becomes more problematic to those organizations that don't have those facilities or have not been in the business that long. So it's a combination of those issues that we want to try to address with the grantees. How do we move forward? The green shoots and the good news, I think, are one, there is enhanced interest in environmental justice I had talked about. We're coming out of the COVID. We're getting vaccinated slowly. Our kids are going, K-8 now, in person. Our grantees could start going in person. We have these sticky areas of HAZWOPER, OSHA 10, the construction courses, forklift training, where there's just not you've got to be in person, but some of those programs have managed to distance themselves and keep into public health protocols. So I think we're coming out of it, and we're going to keep focusing on that. We're going to try to figure out what can we do and what do we need to do as we go into this transitionary time. And hopefully as we move into the new round of grantees, how we can address those people, those new grantees that will be announced this spring, they'll have the advantage of being able to plan through the summer and into the fall, and hopefully their cohorts will be, again, more and more in person than anything else. All of these that I just talked about, we'll put in the notes. And are there any questions or observations that people would like to talk about regarding what they're doing?
This is Ronique from Wilmington, Delaware, West End Neighborhood House. I definitely agree with everything that you just said, Mike. It has been trying times. Typically, pre-COVID, we were, the goal was always to recruit 20 people, and we were pretty much between 15, that 15, 17 number we would bring in. Some people would drop off. During COVID, we've reduced our numbers to 10 people per cohort, and we actually moved from going from twice a year, a fall and a spring, to going quarterly. So in actuality, we pushed back the March cohort, which we traditionally had from last year, and we moved to the summer. And I had 20 people, so I had to split that number up. Ran two summer cohorts, two separate cohorts in the summer. We did a fall. We did a winter, and going in the spring. So my winter cohort will graduate this Friday. And those numbers, you know, fluctuate between a good 8 to 10 people, you know. But for the most part, we still were able to place individuals, environmental, you know, just developing our partnerships on the front end. And definitely during the fall, winter, early winter months, warehouse work on the back end jobs for a lot of individuals. Place a woman from the fall cohort at a CDL, who's working at the Port of Wilmington. Didn't much like the work. She completed the program, and she was able to land a job with Clean Harbors Environmental as a truck driver. And, man, she currently right now, she's looking to make $23 an hour, 40 hours a week with 30 hours mandatory. So that's 70 hours. She's looking to make $100,000, you know, just from that five-week course. Recruitment definitely looks different. I'm seeing a lot of individuals with mental health issues. So we're getting a lot of people with bipolar, schizophrenia, depression and other mental health issues such of that nature. And typically we do assessments even pre-COVID, but coming out of this situation, we did a pre and a post, you know, how individuals came out. And some people were able to help and some people were not, you know. A lot of individuals are not complying with their meds and things of that nature. So it's definitely, you know, it's definitely a situation.
Right.
I mean, I agree with what you said earlier about COVID being a good problem, you know, in a sense for some people. But,
Are you doing in-person training?
We're doing in-person training. Yeah, we definitely are. And everyone who completes our program was more receptive to that, and they appreciate it because they were got back to being on a schedule. You know, we definitely still do with a reentry population. We had some people in a halfway house. You know, we had people who, you know, were looking to get work or who lost jobs. So for them, you know, we go Monday through Friday, and it's 8:45 to 4 p.m. Not every day they will be in at 4 p.m. The earliest they do get out is probably about 3 o'clock or 3:30. But the structure of them being there every day, they appreciate it, and they speak on that during their evaluations and even going into those last couple of weeks. So
how were you able to, do that HAZWOPR? Or how did you find a trainer that was able to help them out with that?
Yeah. I mean, the first week we just do social emotional learning, and for that 3 week period, we have a contractor. We did with Mark Schlager, Aztec, environmental. He comes in and he spends 3 weeks. He'll spend 2 weeks himself, and he has another contractor that he uses that comes in and does a week for our OSHA 40 HAZWOP.
Fantastic.
And that's all.
That's
that
a big issue.
Yeah.
You've been able to do something that a lot of grantees have found to be a real stumbling block and keeping them from starting their cohort is that HAZWOPR and maybe an OSHA 10 or OSHA 30 where you need to have in person, and it's a struggle for them to find trainers that will do it, but you have.
Yeah.
So that's fantastic.
Yeah. But I've also goes on to the many conversations we had last year, and I mentioned to you, you know, previously, like recruitment had to be not drastically changed, but you really, really had to recruit even harder, and you had to find people who really valued the opportunity, you know, who were people who were going to be there every day. You know, like I mentioned to like everyone who we do recruit, like I try to burn that in their brains, man. You got to be here. The commitment must be for 5 weeks, Monday through Friday, you know, from 8:45 to 4 p.m. I mean, this last group was a great, we did a great job of creating a community for them. I mean, the first week they were bringing donuts, like on Friday. You know, one individual bought lunch. We had a small group just go around. So one guy, you know, he's just so appreciative of being there. I mean, they were doing that. You know, once you create that community within themselves, man, they just they want to help themselves and each other. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah. I mean, that was a great plus
you
had the last couple of jumps.
You're going to have great retention rates because that's the number one key is getting them to form a team. That's fantastic.
Exactly. And we mentioned that in past PLC meetings as well, too. So I was definitely adamant about that. And
you're finding that they're looking for people with credentials now, as we've heard from other people, that, you know, once they get those certs, there's people looking for them in a whole lot of areas.
Most definitely. And there's a lot of people interested in going into the private sector and becoming entrepreneurs as well, too, in regards to that. You know, we added a COVID-19 cleanup. So we actually trimmed it. We used to give out 12. So we do OSHA 40, OSHA confined space entry, OSHA 10, bloodborne pathogens, a forklift training, a COVID-19 cleanup, and mold remediation, and lead renovation and repair.
That's great. I mean, that bloodborne pathogen. So more and more people are throwing that in their curriculum. Because it's great for decontamination. People perceive that as a credential that works in this era. What now? Your students don't. You're not doing hybrid or anything, are you? You're just flat.
No,
person, right?
Yeah, everything is in person.
Fantastic.
So I mean, it has to be that way. We also house the GED program that is hybrid. They're hybrid because their numbers are different, but we're confined to a classroom for pretty much half of the day. Our GED students leave the premises facility at 1 o'clock. So around 1 o'clock, 1:30, we'll go over to our computer lab. And that's when the first week we'll do, career readiness stuff, like updating your resume, creating your resume and some mock interviews. But we're confined to that one room for that 5 week period. And they make appointments just to see like an employment specialist or things of that nature. Just so, you know, we just keep the numbers down of people intermingling and things of that nature.
Renique, that's fantastic what you're doing.
Right.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's a process.
Now, you know, we have another person. Chris is online from Santa Fe. They're doing now. They're doing a lot of DOE training, but they're doing again also face to face. You all are doing some hybrid too, aren't you, over there?
So Janet was able to convert a lot of the curriculum to online that we're offering at Los Alamos at this time. But starting last week, they are requiring Janet to go one day a week to deliver in-person training because of the hands-on component with some of the training equipment. So now she's once a week going up to Los Alamos in person. And we've actually put on hold our HazWalkers and OSHAs for the time being. We have several of them that we just had to put on break. We're going to try and do in-person again starting in March. 10 people only and using big municipal and client facilities so people can really spread out. If the weather is at all decent, putting part of the training outside as well, which has required microphones and trying to figure out outdoor technology.
You know, I think you've kind of hit it. We seem to be getting the 10 person, the distance, the spreading out, trying to find facilities, whether it's Cypress Mandela or Recycle Force or spreading place where you have lots of room and spreading people out seems to be one of the better mitigation strategies that seem to be working. Very neat. But again, it sounds like you really do need that in-person component, no matter who you're dealing with. Is going to have implications.
I think it's important, too, because it really lets the instructors evaluate if the students are actually getting the training and understanding it and performing properly.
Right. And, you know, as Renique said, this recruiting is going to be a challenge. It's going to be a little different than it used to be. You used to look at underserved population who were worthy, who were interested, but more important, you knew were going to complete the program. And one of the biggest problems people have right now with COVID is keeping people engaged. They seem to have a problem keeping focused and engaged for a whole lot of reasons, whether it's transportation to wherever you're going. Some have wrestled with that. For example, your students may have to go to a facility, whether it's a forklift facility, where they could spread out, but you have to get there. Some of the contractor trainers are taking care of the transportation, which we talked about the last time. And that's one mitigation effort, but that it does make recruitment a little trickier. And as I said, if you decide to go hybrid, that's going to change your recruiting totally, because now you're looking at a different class of knowledge that they're going to need to get into the program, which we've never had computer literacy as a screening tool for bringing our students into the Environmental Workforce Development Job Training Program, which some of you may keep it that way and want to keep it that way. Some of you may need to change that. We don't, you know, that's your decision. As I said, these programs are so diverse that there's all ranges of students that are participating in the programs. Anyone else that would like to talk about what they're doing?
Hi, Mike. It's Rita Ware, Region 6. I just wanted to tell you that Shalonda Baker's book is available on Amazon. There's a hardcover and a Kindle version.
I'm going to put in the two things. I'm going to put in some background on Shalonda, and I'm going to reference there was a Science Friday show about they had her on the show. Amazing woman. She's been dedicated to energy justice for a long time and very knowledgeable. I was impressed by what I heard. Very intelligent woman. And I don't know where these green shoots are going to be as far as it relates to the EPA. Some of our grantees may find this relationship really interesting, and it may not affect others at all, but it'll be interesting as this progresses. Energy and environment overlaps very closely. Many programs, as they mature, turn into energy and environmental programs. Thanks, Rhonda, for that. Anything else? Okay, I'll put reference to that publication in the notes, and perhaps hopefully we'll be hearing more about this in the future. Well, I think our free conference call is telling us it's time to leave this week. I hear some groaning and grunting, so our next session will be in 2 weeks, and hope to see you all then. February 24th.
Mike, is there any information on when the grant, see what's going on? The grant reviews or?
I always publish, I put in there kind of a version of how things could look. I did it last PLC. Every couple of PLCs, I put a little note on. It's not anything you see in the PLC notes is not official, but if it looks like it might have looked like last year, I put a schedule in from now through your first cohort, and we're in my mind, and this may be totally off, but I'm thinking we're thinking of spring. I don't know if anyone from EPA may want to challenge that. Now, what spring? Well, spring or early summer, so we might be March, April, May, but we know one hard fact is they need to get these out the door by September 31st, because that's the end of the fiscal for using that money. And so when you start backing things up on what it takes to get work plans approved, what it takes to do that, these announcements would are going to probably have to be made, or recommendations for announcements, you know, sometime March, April, May, and in that time frame. Now, because we don't have an exact date, I wouldn't bother. There's never been a year where we've gotten a date that says when they're going to do it, because there are so many variables when the EPA, and I have to say, they have to go through a lot of hoops, a lot of clearances, and so, and particularly with the COVID thing going on, I would say it's going to happen this spring, and certainly as if we hear more, we'll pass it on. Given the little what we have information, I usually post in the PLC notes a schedule, and I can put one in this week too of our kind of estimation, very rough estimation of how this would fall out. And if you look at that, it shows late spring, the awards, and then working your work plans, getting your work plans ready, and getting your planning going before all of that would be done. Of course, before September, and then you'd be planning through the summer, maybe starting your first cohort in the fall of this year. So, and actually the timing may work out well, because hopefully COVID will start to end. You know, you are, many of you are already working around COVID now. So when we get into October timeframe, you'll be in good shape and you can start doing some cohorts and be in time for placing students next spring in the southern parts of the country. You'll be able to place some students earlier. So that's kind of the general thinking, I would say. But what more we find, the more we'll pass on to you. Anyone have anything to add to that that I don't know about? Okay.
Has there been any discussion about increased appropriations, or, you know, how the program might expand in this new administration?
Well, we would love it, and I've always been an advocate for supplementals. I don't know that that's anything that would ever happen, and I wouldn't hate to say to anyone, you know, I, from my point of view, there have been a lot of programs that have had to work on fumes for the last 6 months, 7 months. So, you know, I think it would be appropriate to have supplemental to some of the grantees. I feel bad for the second year grantees who are, you know, burning cash and had to close down their classes. I don't know. It's got to be a real challenge for them. It would be nice if there's an increase. It would be nice if there was a supplemental, but we just haven't heard anything. I haven't heard anything about that. The only thing I heard was, I believe that Brownfields in general got a couple million more. Now, whether that goes to the technical side of the shop or the, you know, the Brownfields revolving loan fund and the cleanup, or some of that might flow over to us. We just don't know. But we'll keep in mind, you know, the only thing I would say is if you ever have a chance to suggest that, it sure would be nice to have supplementals. That would be nice, or increased funding. To give you a background, you know, EPA never wanted this program to be too big, because they always felt that if it was too big a program, it would be a place to go after in hard times to reduce it. So they've, over the dozen, a couple dozen years, they've tried to keep it kind of slim and, you know, low key. It should be nice to give everyone another 100,000 or so, in my mind. But we'll just have to play that out, see what happens. But
you
all do incredible work, you know, for particularly for the funding you're given. It's when you compare with Department of Labor program, our grantees, we're placing grantees, what, 7,000 or 8,000 per person, compared to 15 or 20 for other programs, and of course keeping someone in prison, 30 to 50,000. It's everyone's getting a real bargain because of this program. That's one thing for sure. Anything else? Well, thanks everyone, and have a great couple of weeks, and we'll be back on the 24th.
Thank you.
We'll see you then. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Mike.
Bye.